you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we talk about it. I am joined today by the former editor-in-chief of Fangoria and a current columnist for Fangoria and just a general consultant producer for all things horror, Tony Tampone. Hey, Tony, how are you?
Okay, Danny, I'm doing great. Happy Halloween.
Happy early Halloween. Not yeah. Too early, because we're pretty close now. By the time this goes out, we're gonna be really close to Halloween. Gosh, you've been in the horror game for kind of a minute. Just a little while.
Yeah, since 1985, I started with Fangoria. But before that, I was weaned on horror films. I was writing for horror and science fiction magazines while I was still in high school and college. And I started making a real career out of it starting in 1985. And it's been a great ride. You know, every day I like getting up and immersing myself in horror entertainment. And it's just, I couldn't ask for a better job. It's great. It's so good. It's scary.
Yeah. And Fangoria kind of just had a big relaunch. You went to an event right around New York Comic Con at my old stomping grounds, the store that I worked at for many years before I became a person that podcasts professionally, Forbidden Planet. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was. It was a great launch, a relaunch party. Fangoria had been off newsstands for like 3 years, and the company got sold to this terrific bunch of guys out of Texas, a film production company called CineState. And they relaunched a magazine in a big way. They put out the first new issue in a long time this October. And we're having another launch party actually this weekend at the Los Angeles Comic Con. I'll be out there with the current editor, Phil Nobile Jr., and also another former editor, Chris Alexander. And we'll be there on Saturday talking all things horror. And people could buy copies of Fangoria and meet the new staff. So that's exciting. It's a perfect season for it too.
Yeah. So in that first issue that came out, what did you do? What did you end up writing about?
I wrote about the early days of the magazine in a column called Elegies that I'll be doing for every issue. It's sort of spawned from my original editorial page in the 20 plus issues that I used to edit the magazine. So I went into my background and the magazine's background, how it came to be named Fangoria, the secret history of Fangoria as it is. And yeah, that's what I wrote about for number one. And then future columns I'll write about are the history of our conventions and some of the cool people who used to pop into the Fangoria offices in New York and some of the other horror things Fangoria has been up to, the radio show, books, movies, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of ground to cover.
Is there something in there that you could sort of like give a tease to, like one secret, one like kind of fun thing that you've done in your career there that's kind of like a fun little factoid that's going to be coming out or has already come out in that first issue?
How the magazine got its name. Originally, it was going to be called Fantastica, and it was going to be more like fantasy, Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and dragons and Doctor Who aliens and stuff like that. But then there was another publication at the time called Fantastic Films, and they sued our publisher saying that Fantastica encroached on their brand. So they had to do a last minute retitling of the magazine, and the co-publisher Norman Jacobs was taking a shower one night, and then the name Fangoria just popped into his head, and the title was born, and it stuck through thick and thin.
Yeah, I gotta say, I think all of my best ideas come in the shower. So that is a relatable tale if ever there was. Listen, I don't want to belabor any further. You picked just a little known film that almost no one's ever heard of before. Which one was it?
It was Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 landmark Psycho.
Other than because it's arguably one of the greatest, most important horror films of all time, why did you pick this particular one?
I just love Psycho to death. You know, I could watch it every week and always find something new to enjoy about that film. It's the, you know, it's the granddaddy of the slasher film. It's one of Alfred Hitchcock's greatest films and I think his most successful films. It's just an A-class production all across the board. It's got great acting. It's got that wonderful score by Bernard Herrmann. It's got some very shocking murder scenes that really had people screaming in the theaters back in 1960 when it first came. It was a big media sensation and blockbuster film that would go on to inspire sequels and remakes and TV shows and books. It's been a bonanza ever since. And the film really has stood the test of time. It's a wonderful movie. It's suspenseful. It also has a real undercurrent of dark humor. And as a matter of fact, Hitchcock even said during interviews at the time that he saw Psycho as a comedy. And it actually is very funny, but I don't think it's in the same kind of comedic vein as, say, there's Something About Mary or Police Academy. It's more of a really dark, black, pitch black humor. And it's just a film that constantly delights me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And yeah, I mean, I think so. Just very quickly, in case people don't know, Psycho is just a little film about a son and his complex relationship with his mother. Yeah, I mean, look, it's a film wherein a young woman who just wants to get away from her life and get married to a guy who's in debt, steals $40,000 very sort of thoughtlessly and finds herself at this place called the Bates Motel. And unfortunately, it turns out that hotel is run by a psycho, which is why the movie's called Psycho. And he kills her and then he kills everybody that tries to come looking for her until he's finally captured. And the big thing about it at the time was that if somehow, I mean, like, at that, you know, in 1960, there was no reason for you to know. But the thing that everybody knows now is that, you know, you're supposed to think it's his mother the whole time. But in fact, you know, it's him dressed as his mother. And that in 1960 was very shocking.
And that sure was. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's just sort of the gist of what the film is. But the layers kind of leading up to it, I think, are the first thing that are interesting. So you mentioned that it was in some ways his most successful film. And do you remember? I mean, it was certainly in the sense that he made many millions of dollars off of this. But do you remember the reason why he made so much money?
It was a very low budget film. Hitchcock shot Psycho with his crew from his TV show that he was using, on a weekly basis, on a daily basis. So they really banged it out pretty quickly. He put a lot of his own money into the film. It cost $800,000 to produce at the time. It was shot very quickly, you know, on the back lot. And he shot in black and white. He saved money there too, even though he's been producing a lot of big directing a lot of big movies in color during this period. You know, he decided to go black and white for Psycho. And the film went on to make $15 million when it was released in 1960, which was a big deal back then. Now, you know, films do that in their first day, but Psycho, back when it was like 25 cents to see a movie, that was a lot of money for a picture like that. And it was also the first really adult horror movie. You know, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, horror films were looked at as films for kids almost, you know, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, giant ant movies. They were the kind of movies that 13-year-old boys went to see. But Psycho was a horror film that appealed to, you know, adults, you know, people, you know, in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s who could go, see the film and enjoy it. And it really wasn't meant for kids like, you know, the films of other generations, and really spoke to that generation. And it was just a very shocking picture, you know, the murder and the shower murder, which is still disturbing to this day. really galvanized audiences back then, and you had everybody talking. It was probably the first water cooler horror movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly up there. I think it's also pretty notable that Paramount? They didn't really want to make it, and they basically said, we don't want to pay you for this. And his agreement was that he would take, I think it was like some crazy number, like 60%, in lieu of not being paid to make the movie, because everybody was convinced that it was going to flop. And so, yeah, he made many, many, many millions of dollars off of it. Now, my question to you is, do you remember the first time you saw it? How old were you? Do you remember what the year would have been?
Yeah, I was in grammar school. It was showed up on late night TV. I'd always read about Psycho and heard about it, but I didn't know the kicker ending. And it was on late night TV because no network would air it during prime time because of the subject matter. So there I was, 11, 12 o'clock watching it all by myself. I was, like I said, it was maybe in the sixth grade or the seventh grade. I might have even been a preteen. And my mother kept trying to get me to go to bed as I was watching this movie because she wasn't used to me staying up late. I had school the next day probably. So as I'm watching the movie, it was probably just after the shower murder. My mom goes, "Oh, come up to bed." It winds up that Norman is really his mother.
Oh, she ruined it.
The movie for me. I couldn't believe it. I never saw that. I never would have seen that coming. This was before the internet, before spoilers were so common. And she ruined the film for me. And I've never forgiven her for that.
Well, in that way, it makes the movie very relatable. You can really relate to Norman.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, I could see what could drive a man to kill his own mother.
You see, that's your mother. Wait, you didn't kill your mother, did you? You didn't do that,
no,
did you?
No.
Okay,
no.
Okay. All right. Good, good.
If
you did, good. Yeah, you don't want to say that on a podcast. So if it's a lie, I appreciate the lie. But that's I do find it interesting that so many people who have come on the show have a tendency to pick movies that they saw when they were really young and probably shouldn't have seen the movie that they saw, because even though that's ruined for you, even though your mother was like, "Here's what happens, kid, come to bed," it still, I'm sure, must have had an impact on you.
Oh, sure, yeah. Of course, the shower scene, was pretty dramatic. I don't think I'd ever seen a naked woman on screen before, partially naked. The murder of Arbogast on the stairs, that really freaked me out. That was a real shocker. And of course, final revelation of Mother in the fruit cellar, that was a real jolt as well.
So contextually, if we're sort of looking at Psycho as a moment, I think we have to sort of talk about what sort of precedes it. Because if you look at as I recall, Hitchcock sort of was looking at the movies that were coming out that were these sort of low budget B horror films. And he thought, well, these are making a lot of money. What would happen if somebody that could make a movie that didn't suck made something in this genre? And what's sort of interesting about it is that I don't know that he was really thinking about the sort of late day Universal stuff. Because, by the time you get to the 1950s, you're looking at more like Creature of the Black Lagoon and that variety. The stuff that was sort of the end of the Universal Monsters era. I think who he was probably looking at, who he was targeting, who he was kind of giving a middle finger to was William Castle, who by the late 50s, I think, had quite a bit of notoriety as being this guy who would tell the audience before the movie came out, "You're going to be terrified," and would come up with all these gimmicks and stuff. He'd have the Tingler come out, and certain theaters, they'd have the thing underneath the seat that when the Tingler, when the titular Tingler would appear, you'd get a shake, your seat would vibrate. And sort of stuff like that. And I think a year before, I think that came out a year before Psycho did. And I think the same was true of House on Haunted Hill. And I think what's interesting about those is that you can sort of see the two of them knocking around doing similar things because, William Castle would do TV shows where he, and even his, with his movies, he would sort of appear at the beginning with his cigar and introduce a thing. And, you know, when Alfred Hitchcock Presents was sort of the same shtick, and Hitchcock would always, you know, he would always appear in the background of his movies. So it, what's interesting is that they are opposing contemporaries, and yet, despite the fact that I don't think Hitchcock really liked William Castle very much, gosh, he does all of the same shtick for Psycho.
Yeah,
not just
the
movie itself.
He was sort of the low rent Hitchcock.
He was also
looking at the success of the Hammer films, which were also coming out in the late 50s, that they were acquired by studios like Warner Brothers, Columbia, and Universal. They were gobbling up these, you know, low-budget gothic horror movies, and they were very successful. I think Hitchcock might have been looking at those as well. And the funny thing is, you know, Hitchcock might have been trying to take something away from the Castle playbook. After the success of Psycho, William Castle started doing all these Psycho knockoffs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it was back and forth. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, what I was thinking about was the fact that, you know, they would do all this stuff at the theaters, you know, like they'd have a timer, you know, like you'd hear music play and then they would say 10 minutes to Psycho time, you know, 5 minutes to Psycho time. And then there was like a cardboard cutout of Hitchcock with something about, you know, like if you don't get in on time, you know, if you try to sneak into the theater after the movie starts, you know, you'll be beaten or something ridiculous, you know, some sort of crazy thing, which to me is very William Castle. That's got that sort of like, yeah, gimmicky 1950s, late 1950s sort of vibe to it. But I think in a way, as tongue in cheek as it was, Hitchcock was pretty method in both with the audience and then in the process of filming it, because people didn't know when they were filming what the ending was going to be. Didn't he have everybody sign a lot? This is before, like, you know, spoiler culture that we live in now, but he sort of made sure that nobody talked about anything that was happening in the movie. It was all very, very hush hush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the campaign for Psycho was that nobody would be admitted once the film began, because back in those days, you know, people just show up at the movies and they make a whole, disturb the audience and to ruin the experience. He wanted everybody to see the film from the start, which was really a wise move. And I think they actually enforced that at theaters when it first came out, which is great, because nothing's more distracting when you're sitting there getting into a film and someone shows up 20 minutes in and they're getting settled and distracting you with their, you know, barrel sized popcorn and, you know, their coats and that kind of stuff. So I wish there was more of that kind of stuff today.
There are a couple of smaller theater houses and like Alamo Drafthouse and stuff like that where you've got to, I don't know if they force you in at a certain time, but certainly once you're there, you get to turn off your phone. If they catch you looking at your phone, they kick you out,
no talking,
and that kind of stuff.
And you know, you just have to deal with the, you know, the waiters scrambling in the dark.
But he was pretty Hitchcock, like I said, even prior to the film being released, because it was based on a Robert Bloch novel. And
right.
I mean, I don't know if this is apocryphal or what, but, you know, he sort of bought the rights anonymously and then proceeded to like buy up all the copies of the book so that no one could read it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Which is crazy. Yeah. And I think, you know, in 2018, if something like that happened, I'd say, yeah, that sounds right. That sounds like something that a person would do now, because that's the culture. But in 1960, it really was not at all. I can't, like, it's shocking to me to think of something, you know, that, you know, like now almost, you know, almost 60 years ago, it would be, somebody would go to those lengths to prevent people from knowing anything. But here's my question. You got spoiled for it. How much do you think the movie was ruined for you because your mother told you?
Oh, you know, it really wasn't ruined, because there was just so much to enjoy and love. And to, you know, the film just opened my eyes so much to, you know, editing and music, all the other components that come together to make a great film. You know, it was such a learning experience watching Psycho to see that artistry, that craft involved. Because before that, you know, I was used to watching, you know, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein and, you know, a lot of them and the B movies of the 50s, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon and stuff like that, which, you know, were more geared towards children. And of course, those films were wonderful and well made and all. But here was a movie, again, that was really for adults. And the performances were so good, especially Janet Leigh, who wound up getting nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her part in the movie. She was so good. And Anthony Perkins is such a delight to watch. You know, he ad-libbed some stuff in the film, and his mannerisms, his twitches. It was just such a thrill to see it and appreciate it on so many different levels, from a fright level, from a psychological level. You know, again, that was that black undercurrent of dark humor in the film. So good to experience this film, and I've watched it again and again. Over the years, I've seen it on the big screen, the small screen, and I never get bored with it. I never get tired of Psycho.
Talk about the experience of rewatching it over and over again. I find that the movies that I watch over and over again, there are certain things that, like, new stuff I'll get on each rewatch. It's like, yeah, what have you found? What are things that you sort of found yourself appreciating on, you know, like your 10th or 12th? Watch the movie. What are the things that you catch, like those really, really subtle nuances?
Some of the symbolic stuff that's going on. Like, there was this creepy highway patrolman in the movie who kind of startles Janet Leigh's character, Marion Crane, when she's sleeping on the roadside. And you know, I did some reading up on Hitchcock, and he had this childhood fear of authority and police. So I thought that really capitalized on that fear. And then I enjoy watching all the character actors in the film who were doing a lot of TV at the time, like John Anderson. He was a California Charlie, the pushy car salesman, and he was in several of Hitchcock's TV shows, and he was also on a lot of the original Twilight Zone. So I always get a kick out of seeing people, like, familiar faces like that in small roles. The cinematography, that beautiful crisp cinematography by John Russell, that is just so awesome to look at. He was a DP who worked, again, a lot of TV, thriller, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, even shot episodes of The Munsters. And, you know, his lens captures, you know, every shadow, every raindrop, the shower spray. For example, and such detail, such crisp detail. You know, I love the give and take between Norman and Marion's sister and her boyfriend when they show up at the motel. You know, that the great banter that goes on between the John Gavin character and Norman Bates when he's trying to break Norman and trying to get inside his head and find out what went on. And then just the dialogue too. There's so many great lines in the film. You know, that you could just keep repeating, you know, like when Norman says about his mother, she just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. You know, haven't you? You know, I love the dialogue or when he says about his mother, you know, boy's best friend is his mother. Things like, it was the first film to ever show a flushing toilet. And that was revolutionary at the time, so. The ground it broke with even something as simple as that. You know, not only did it have a shower scene, a murder in graphic detail that we'd never seen before, but you got a flushing toilet for the first time. So there's so much, yeah. So much.
It's so funny that there's all these mentions of birds, you know, but whether it's the last name Crane or whether or not that's the fact that, you know, that Norman is doing taxidermy, and that he primarily does taxidermy on birds. And then by 1963, Hitchcock has made the birds. And I think that's interesting. And I think it's, some of the camera tricks I really like when Arbogast goes down the steps That's a really great shot, you know, and it almost evokes something, a bit of vertigo to it. And then, yeah, and I like the shower scene, but I also love that they use a different camera specifically for the shot where Norman is looking at Marion through the hole in the wall, like specifically designed to make it sort of, they used a camera type that imitated the eye a little bit better so that it would feel sort of like you were in the position of Norman. And I think that in particular is something that I find very interesting, because I don't know that this film doesn't really have one singular POV character. Like, there's not one person, because, you know, you're following Marion for a while, but then she bites it.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's not her after that.
Was
so revolutionary at the time. Yeah. That was what were really stunned audiences, because they thought we were going to see this lady from the beginning of the movie to the end, and there she gets killed 45 minutes in, and it's a real game changer. The movie resets at that point, and the focus goes on to Norman. It's just so brilliant.
Yeah, I think there's a number of films that sort of, like, looking at this one, especially in a rewatch now, having, you know, been in having the honor of watching at least one horror movie every day and this month, and just, you know, constantly rewatching films over and over again. This rewatch of Psycho, there are certain things, like that reset of losing a character made me think of when Wes Craven did the first Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, there's a completely, before you get to Nancy, there's a different woman that you start with for a while that you're following for the first act of the picture, and then she bites it, and then all of a sudden now you're with Nancy. And I, you know, I sometimes wonder whether or not Wes Craven would have thought to do something like that without something like Psycho. And I wonder if Exorcist would have had the willingness to spend so much, because, you know, like, you look at something like The Exorcist and people, everything they think about is the third act. And what's interesting about Psycho is that, you know, everybody knows Psycho, but most people don't know 90% of Psycho. They're not thinking about the film as a whole. They're not thinking of all that slow buildup. They're thinking about A, the shower scene, and B, the basement scene. That's it. That's what people think of, honestly, when they think of Psycho. And yet, the things that make those moments so well earned are all of these small building creeping terror things that are happening throughout the whole movie. And I wonder about even just the entire filmmaking of the 1970s would have been drastically different. I mean, without Alfred Hitchcock in general, but certainly without Psycho specifically. And yeah, I mean, there's a million things that you sort of look and realize. I did a separate podcast for a different show about Herschel Gordon Lewis and Blood Feast. And I think that the opening of Blood Feast, the difference is it's in color and it's gorier, and that's it. Otherwise, would Herschel Gordon Lewis have ever thought to do the thing that he did? I think he just looked at what he was doing already with, like, how he transitioned from Nudie Cuties to Ruffies, and then said, well, what's next? And he looked at what he'd done, and I think he looked at Psycho and said, put the two together, put them in color, and the splatter picture is, to me, the beginning of true run and gun, making crazy, gory horror movies on a budget. So in a weird way, Psycho even has an influence on something like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely, yeah. And of course, a few decades later, John Carpenter's Halloween. He was heavily influenced by Hitchcock and Psycho, so much so he even cast Janet Leigh's own daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, as his lead actress. So
yeah,
you know, you feel the influence there, of course.
Yeah. And then you know, to be able to finally complete that journey and do The Fog and actually bring, you know, Janet Leigh into the film, you know. Not too many years after that, which is pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's talk about Janet Leigh, though. What a performance, because the really, like, about, I don't want to say 40 to 50% of the film is the fact that you really, really, really have to be invested in this person when they die. And Janet Leigh really gets to, you know, whatever complex relationship Hitchcock's leading ladies may have had with Alfred Hitchcock, the performance that she gives is really, I think, second to none. It's just incredible.
And you know, the Academy recognized that, and you know, they gave her Best Supporting Actress nomination. And unlike other actresses who worked with Hitchcock, who said bad things about him in later years, Janet Leigh never really had a bad thing to say about him. She really, you know, loved the experience of working with him on the film. It traumatized her in many ways. Supposedly, she could never get into a shower after Psycho.
I like that they came up with this sort of notion of, what was that? The first thing you see her in, her underwear is white, and then she steals the money.
Right.
And then when she's at the hotel, I mean, this is a, you know, this is not her acting, but an aesthetic choice that they came up with. But yeah, like she underwear is white, purse is white, steals the 40 grand. Now all of a sudden, everything that she wears is black.
Right.
It's kind of, it's kind of an interesting choice.
Like that. That's why you keep rewatching, because you pick up on things like that that you might not have noticed before. It wasn't just, you know, a doc show. There was real artistry and intelligence going on behind the scenes.
And there's a great parallel, and this will kind of lead us into talking about Anthony Perkins too, of Janet Leigh playing Marion as kind of, I mean, she's just losing her mind, you know, because she really thinks she's going to get caught. She trades her car to try and, like, stay off the grid, make it so that people can't find her so easily. And, they play out this whole thing where she's in the car and she's imagining how everything is playing out as people are figuring out that she's stolen the money. And, you know, it's what I like about it is that there are parts where she seems nervous, but there are also parts where she seems really self-satisfied with the bad thing that she's did.
Right.
Like she's that she's just fed up, and that, you know, she feels like she's gotten her way, and that, like, thinking about people being so mad, she's smiling like, got him. And I love that. Uh-huh. I like that they're sort of like all the stuff that's just on her face. We get that same thing again. I think there's a parallel to be drawn between that and then, how you read sort of Anthony Perkins face. And gosh, I hadn't seen him in a while. I had not watched this movie in a minute, and he's so charming at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so likeable.
You really wouldn't you wouldn't know. He comes on the screen and I was like, I know this guy goes to my bar. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I saw him, I was like, this is a guy that goes like, oh, have you tried that IPA yet? Like, he seems like such a regular guy. Do you know what I mean? He seems like a guy that I'm buddies with that lives around the neighborhood. It really speaks to the elasticity of the performance that he's able to do that and then take it as far opposite as I think that he does. What's sort of your impression upon your last rewatch of Anthony Perkins' performance in this?
Just that he's so likable, as you mentioned, that we almost kind of feel bad when he gets caught at the end, and when little things kind of drive him crazy, like when the car won't sink, when he dumps it in the swamp, and you really feel bad for him, and you're rooting for him in a really twisted kind of way, because, you know, he's a pretty messed up guy. You know, he had this real twisted relationship with his mother that continues to haunt him, and he's kind of not responsible for his actions. And, you know, we want to see him get rehabilitated or at least find some kind of happiness.
Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting because you really do sort of struggle with the idea of, what is his main personality and what is something else, especially by the time you get to the end, because of the dubious nature of the voiceover that's not his voice at all. But there's some stuff that he does, like when Arbogast comes to ask him questions. I think it's so interesting, and part of this is the scripted, part of it is also the performance, that Norman at first tries to just say, oh, there's nothing to see here, and leave it at that. But once he's caught in it, he really almost, he becomes like how serial killers are, like they want to be caught. But they try to bring the investigator in on a little bit of a game, you know, like try to lead them into a maze to see if they can figure it out. And
Right. Yeah. See, that's something I never noticed before. That's so true. Yeah.
Yeah, I do think that he, in a way, at that moment, is questioning whether or not he's going to have to kill Arbogast or not. But I don't think he's against the idea, and I think he certainly is inviting Arbogast to get too close. You know, he's inviting him to step into the parlor, as it were. I like that. Yeah, this latest rewatch of it, I found myself seeing, you know, what I think are, you know, and maybe it's just that I've watched it so many times that now I'm assigning things that maybe necessarily aren't there, but that is something that I got off of this particular rewatch. And yeah, I mean, like, is he the killer? Is it his mother's psyche that's the killer? You know, because at the end, it's the mother's voice saying, you know, I wouldn't hurt a fly. And you go, well, what's the truth? What's the real, I mean, like, they explore it in sequels, but, you know, that's a very different conversation. Like so many films that become franchised after the fact, they almost feel like they're just one possible interpretation and probably not the right one. And I find myself feeling like there is just so much ambiguity in those final moments as to, you know, other than the fact that there's something wrong with him, it's like, is there a mother character in there? And if so, is the mother really the one that's doing the killing, or is it Norman who in fact was the original killer? Is it that he's the killer and she's in there trying to convince him not to? Like, the whole thing is just so bizarre to me. And I don't think, you know, like one psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever coming in trying to understand why he did what he did, you know, doesn't necessarily give you the final answer. I think that they sort of leave you with the lights off rather than on. I think you really, you know, just like Hitchcock was a believer in the things that you didn't see more so than the things that you did, I still think that there's this information that he doesn't quite make explicit that I really like.
Yeah, that's so true. That's, again, these are all the little things you pick up on, you know, what multiple viewings.
Let's just say as a hypothesis, somebody watches Psycho and they go, I like that. That was great. Like they watch it for the first time somehow, or they've seen it before and they're like, I'm not going to watch that one again. But they're interested in watching something that's similar. What would you recommend? Like what's a good balance? What's a good another film to watch?
So maybe some of the films that also sprung from Psycho's own origins, because Psycho, the story of Norman Bates was loosely based on a real Wisconsin serial killer named Ed Gein, who terrorized the Midwest back in the 1950s. He used to dig up corpses and skin the bodies and wear their body suits, and he murdered several women and cut them up like deer and hung them in his shed and that kind of stuff. And other films that were inspired by the misdeeds of Ed Gein are Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Tobe Hooper film, 1974, Silence of the Lambs. Again, the killer took something from the Ed Gein playbook and the way he used to skin people. You know, not the Hannibal Lecter character, the other guy. And also Halloween, again, I mentioned, even though these films are more graphic and follow more of the horror basics, I think, you know, if you like Psycho, you'll definitely like those movies as well. Also, if you want more, a psychological terror, there's a French movie called Diabolique that Hitchcock was really jealous of because it was so scary and suspenseful, and it drove him crazy that a film could do something even better than he was doing. That's going to be on Turner Classic Movies this month. And that's directed by Henry Clouzot. So that's a film that, again, is a real dark psychological thriller about these women who decide to murder a man and the repercussions. And let's see, Repulsion, the Roman Polanski film. That's about a disturbed woman, sort of like a female Norman Bates in a way. That's a film that if you're looking again for a real dark psychological thriller, no humor at all in that one. But it's about a woman slowly going mad, played by Catherine Deneuve.
I think it makes sense to go back a little bit in Hitchcock's oeuvre if you want something. I mean, I would 100% recommend Rope and...
Well, even Frenzy. Frenzy was sort of a follow-up to Psycho. It was about the necktie murderer in London. And that even was more extreme than Psycho. There was nudity, there was a rape, and also some pretty nasty murders, and also has the wrong man accused plot that we see in other of Hitchcock's suspense classics. And that's, you know, a film that doesn't get much attention and deserves it.
I would say go back and rewatch. I would rewatch Shadow of a Doubt also.
Yeah, that was Hitchcock's favorite movie. Yeah, with Joseph Cotten as Uncle Charlie.
It's great. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic one. And yeah, if you want some blood and guts, I had mentioned Blood Feast. Why not? If you want to see what one of the sort of responses to or a film that I think shortly thereafter couldn't have existed without Psycho. Sure. What the hey? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, give a shot to Blood Feast. What a crazy goddamn movie that is. It's a wild picture. I would say either go back and watch those Hitchcock movies or go forward and watch something that is completely outlandish that couldn't have existed. There's some great episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Heck, you know what? There's a Boris Karloff anthology TV series too called Thriller. That has yes. a couple of episodes that I think would probably be worth your time if you like Psycho for sure.
Yeah, and one of the writers on Thriller was Robert Bloch, so who wrote the original novel with Psycho. So you'll get to see some of his morbid humor and crazy plotting on display.
So yeah, I think all those things are a good suggestion. So all right, so thank you. That we're gonna call it a wrap. I think that we have probably talked Psycho to death after 45 minutes. If someone wanted to find you, not in person, that would be weird, but if they wanted to find you and follow you on the internet, where would they do that, Tony?
Well, I'm Facebook, and I also have a Twitter feed at Tony Timpone 1, where I review current movies, old movies, TV shows, and put photos and things up there, and very regular basis, so.
You have another column coming out in the next issue of Fangoria, right?
Yeah, that'll be out in December, January. I'm also interviewing various horror people for the magazine. I have a piece on Charles Band coming up. So that's a fun one. That's a lots to read and write about. And great time to be a horror fan and a horror contributor, I'll tell you.
Yeah, for sure. I'm really looking forward to, and everybody should be looking forward to you talking to Charles Band. I mean, talk about somebody who had a huge amount of influence on sort of like a lot of low budget horror. Full Moon Features as a whole has gone on to be like pretty potent and powerful, and they've done a lot of things, both big and small, over the years, and are a company that's still around making stuff. So that would be really interested to sort of. Hear what you get out of him, because I do think that he's had an enormous influence.
Yeah, we discussed his top 13 films, what he thinks are his best films, and he left his anecdotes on each one.
There you go. But you probably didn't ask him about his son, the rock star.
No.
Yeah, I don't know why. No, I literally, I have a buddy who's a music reviewer, and he brought up Charles Band to me because he was he does like all old one-hit wonders, and he's like, oh, this guy who did a one-hit wonder about his dad was some guy Charles Band, and I was like, no shit. Anyway, that sounds like a very exciting interview, and I'm looking forward to reading it. My name is Danny Roth. If you go to sci-fi.com, you can find my articles, but also, obviously, because it's October, if you're listening to this in October, there's every single day multiple horror articles and videos and podcasts and all sorts of stuff that's coming out. And you can find all of those at sci-fi.com. You can also find the videos if you go to YouTube under Sci-Fi Wire. I produce a fair amount of them. And if you're looking for me on Twitter or Instagram, you can find me there at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. Thank you for listening to this podcast. And remember, kids, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little every day horror. We'll see you next time.